All right.
Then our next case is in the matter of the welfare of the children of NAR and RP parents. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their oral argument. counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust the microphone to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
John Mack, attorney for the mother. I understand that the court does not want to use actual names, at least of the parties, in a case like this, so I will refer to the appellant as the mother, and I will refer to CP as the child.
Thank you, Mr. Mack.
The court erred when it permitted Meeker County to stop providing services in this case. To be sure, this is a palpable unfitness case, but the palpable unfitness doctrine also includes a question of the duration and the severity of the problems that the mother is having. In this case,
right now, because I understand that a lot of your argument flows from this contention that the county stopped providing services. And I don't know when that would have been, because I'm looking at a January 28, 2019 order that specifically says the county is not relieved of reasonable efforts at this time. So what supports your argument?
I may have been wrong about that, but the thing that I think I should have been arguing and am arguing is the issue of the evidence. And the problem with the evidence here is, I submit, severe. When I was talking about the county stop providing services, what I was really shooting at is when the court denied the motion of the mother's counsel to have a parental capacities of her own provided by the state, or in this case, the county. And I find that this to be, if you will, a stop provisioning of services. But let's look at it as what it was. Almost all, not all, but almost all TPR cases are indigent TPR cases. In the rare case where the mother or the father has sufficient funds to hire an attorney and to hire experts and so forth, in such cases, first of all, TPRs are less often successful. And second, those sorts of cases are often resolved short of final hearing. But the problem here is evidentiary. Now, one of the problems, obviously, that a mother has below, or a father has below, is they have no resources to provide an independent parental capacities examination, to hire experts, to hire psychological examinations of their own. So the court is completely dependent upon what the county's experts say. One of the reasons why this is important is, I'll call it Daubert because it's German, by the way, not French. It's usually pronounced Daubert, but it isn't. In Minnesota, Fry-Mac, which are even more stringent than Daubert. I did it. Anyway, the Fry-Mac indicates strongly that a court is supposed to be a gatekeeper on expert testimony.
They're supposed to be asked to serve as a gatekeeper, aren't they?
Well,
I mean, in this case, there wasn't any objection to the
I know there wasn't, and that is a problem here. But I submit that this is an issue of plain error, and therefore a specific objection is not required. Why? First, we're dealing with one of the most serious issues in the civil law, namely termination of parental rights. So we have to be more careful than we have to in the ordinary automobile accident case. And second, if you read Daubert, and for that matter, Fry-Mac, insofar as they follow Daubert, they indicate nothing about an objection having to be made. If a court is supposed to be a gatekeeper, a court shouldn't simply say, well, we rely strictly on the rule that an objection has to be made. Now, I do most of the appeals for the 8th Judicial District, and I keep telling the people who do the district court work, please, please make a post-trial motion and make an objection. But My personal opinion, which of course is semi-irrelevant, is that parental capacities examination is dubious science. And I've talked to some people who have confirmed that, or at least it is their expert opinion too. And therefore, if we're going to use a parental capacities examination, we have to look very carefully at whether or not the consensus of the scientific community says that this is a proper test, that it is a good test, and that it tells us something. Remember what we have to look at when we're looking at the issue of palpable unfitness. We're looking at whether the unfitness is of such a duration and such a type that it can't be corrected in the immediate future. That's not precisely the wording, but it's basically the concept. And when we do this, parental capacities tests are essential. They're one of the most important things that the court relies on, because that tells them whether they're going to improve in the near future. And once the court has the idea from the parental capacities examination that there won't be an immediate improvement, the war is over, as it were. Therefore, I think that even though there was no objection, that the parental capacities examination should not have been allowed into evidence. Now, the other thing that's important here is that there was evidence.
Counsel, if I may ask a question of you on that. So your position is that was error that is plain because the district court allowed it in without going through the Frymack analysis?
That's correct.
Okay. So if it's error that is plain, well, first of all, there has to be an error because the district court should have sua sponte.
Of course.
What case law is there to show that, assuming there was an error, was plain? No, because it has to be in violation of established case law, precedent, rule, regulation, statute.
Well, it would certainly be in violation of the rule of evidence. And the rule of evidence would be that there has to be a foundation for scientific opinion testimony. And scientific opinion testimony is subject now to Frymack and Daubert, and therefore it's a violation of a specific rule.
Mr. Mack, I'm following up on Judge Reyes's excellent question, and perhaps I'm confused, as I often am. I have never heard the plain error doctrine ever applied to anything but a criminal case. Could you point to me to one civil case where the plain error doctrine has been applied?
I can't right now, no, because that wasn't raised, frankly, in the brief of the opposing counsel, so I didn't have a chance to look it up. I would be willing to do that, but I can't point to one now.
Thank you, Mr. Mack.
Oh. Now, the second problem in this case is there is real evidence from Rob Hastings that she was making substantial improvements before the termination of her parental rights. And the problem with the...
And that's the arms worker or the...
Pardon me?
What was Rob Hastings' involvement with your client?
Rob Hastings was a counselor, and if you look at page
five... Not a therapist, not addressing the underlying multiple mental health needs.
No. But once again, the question arises, the mental health workers were qualified how? Again, that's a Frymack issue. And why was Hastings less able to talk about her condition and her improvements than the mental health professional? I think it was Dr. Myers was the chief witness for the state here. And again, that points out a problem that I pointed out already with regard to the parental capacities examination. These people almost always are poor. They're indigent. And so if they make a request to the court saying, look, I want my own mental capacities examination, I want my own parental capacities examination, the court should almost never say no unless it's unreasonable. There's an important issue at stake here. In a criminal case, obviously, while a court usually has discretion for a mental examination, it will almost always be given. Why wasn't it given in a case as important as the loss of one's child?
Well, my question is, what difference did it make? In the sense, as I recall, the first parental capacity assessment focused on the untreated mental health issues.
And this is true.
The big recommendation was get treatment. Your client didn't. So what had changed? Why would there be any expectation that a second parental capacity assessment when you have untreated mental health problems would be any different?
Well, for one thing, 3 years elapsed between the time of the parental capacities examination in 2016.
But no treatment for mental health in the interim, correct?
I think there was some. I can't recall exactly what, but she did have some contact with either a mental health worker or an emotional health worker. Certainly she did by the time Mr. Hastings became her counselor. And mental health treatment and Mr. Hastings may well intersect. Mr. Hastings did testify that he had training in this sort of counseling where it involved mental health. And certainly if mental health is an issue, and if Mr. Hastings thought that more of it was needed, he would have told the court that. But given whatever capacities, and let's face it, Mr. Hastings would have been subject to Fry Mac too. All of these people should have been. And I wish someone would put out a poster or something to counsel on things like this. Please consider Fry Mac when you're dealing with, because I'd say maybe 60% of what the testimony was in this case was expert testimony. Parental capacities person, mental health worker, for that matter, social workers. What are the standards? What sort of training do they have to have? What is the generally accepted form of treatment in the community? What sorts of credentials do you have to have in order to do that? And there's nothing here. And I'm not criticizing this particular judge or this particular attorney, because I've seen maybe 20 TPRs in the last 10 years or so, and nobody has raised the issue. Frankly, I think it's an issue of first impression. Now, one of the things that troubles me, and this is true of many TPR cases, so it's not a criticism of this particular judge. But the judge had been the judge on the CHIPS petition. And one of the problems of a judge being both the judge on a CHIPS petition and a judge being a judge on a TPR petition is that in most of the cases, the judge has substantially made up his or her mind by the time the TPR comes around. Were it not the case, obviously the judge would have made a determination in the CHIPS petition to reunite the family, and they didn't. Having the same judge make a determination in the CHIPS case as in the TPR case, and many of the criteria involved overlap, makes it fairly clear that the judge, whoever the judge is, ought not really be the judge on the TPR.
No, I mean, apart from whether I agree with your statements or not, I don't see this argument in their brief.
I think it is. Let me.
Well, it's certainly not on a heading. So,
pardon? It's not in the heading. I agree with that.
Well, I think your brief focused on the adverse ruling that now I think you've walked back, the ruling about, or the decision to no longer require reasonable efforts, I think you argue in your brief, was indicative of a decision adverse to your client, and so the judge should have recused. But you've sort of walked back and said, no, the court really didn't relieve the county of efforts, just denied the parental capacity
right.
assessment. And you, is your argument that that is indicative of bias or prejudgment, and the district court should have recused after that?
I think the court should have recused after any kind.
Sua sponte.
Pardon me?
Sua sponte?
Yes, I think sua sponte. Judge.
Isn't the long-term case law that receiving an adverse ruling from a court is not indicative of bias? I mean,
well,
judges rule different, I mean, depending on the issue and the okay. arguments made, it doesn't mean they're prejudging anything just because they've ruled on a requested motion.
Not to because they rule just on a requested motion, I agree with that, but I'm talking about the entire CHIPS process. The judge has to make a finding of whether or not the child should be returned to the home, whether reasonable efforts are being made, whether or not the mother is making progress. All of these things are decided in the CHIPS petition. And then when we get into the TPR position, our petition, the court is asked to make many similar, if not the same, findings. So the problem isn't really prejudice because they made a bad ruling. All of us make mistakes. The whole process is the problem.
Thank you. Your time is up, Mr. Mack. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear counsel for the respondent. And it's my understanding, well, when you get up there, we're just hearing from counsel, just one respondent today.
That is correct.
Thank you, counsel. If you could just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Albright. I'm assistant Meeker County attorney in this case, and I represent Meeker County Social Services, the respondent in this matter. I think it's important to note to the court, based on the briefs that were filed, there are two issues in front of the court, properly raised. And the first issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in relying upon the parental capacity assessment completed in 2016, because that is an evidentiary ruling. And the second is whether or not there's sufficient evidence in the record to support termination of parental rights. Those are the issues before the court. Regarding the parental capacity assessment, the court specifically made findings to this and explained that the factors that supported the underlying parental capacity assessment were static factors, meaning they wouldn't change over time. It was based on prior employment experience, prior family relationship, prior mental health, prior traumatic experience, and yes, prior chemical use experience.
The chemical use did change during the course of the CHIPS proceedings, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't you have an updated parental capacity assessment? Why wouldn't that have been appropriate given mother's successful work on the chemical dependency piece?
I can't speak to why specifically the parental capacity assessment was ultimately not completed. However, the court didn't prevent a mother from getting assessment. In fact, ordered that the assessment can be completed, just that Meeker County wasn't required to pay for that assessment.
Right, but that's a key difference there. It's one thing saying, sure, you can go out and you can get your own assessment, but guess what, we're not going to pay for it, even if you're indigent. And doesn't that put somebody in a rather tough position where, yeah, technically I can get an assessment, but I can't pay for it. If I can't afford it, how am I going to get that assessment? Particularly if it relies on not just static factors, but one particular factor that has changed.
I agree with you. Best practice, probably a parental capacity, updated parental capacity assessment should have been updated. I can't speak to why it wasn't. I do already know that it wasn't refused. However,
why isn't that a failure of reasonable efforts, the failure to fund or to charge the county with funding that second assessment?
Well, it's because there was other assessments in this case completed. In fact, two additional diagnostic assessments were completed in 2018, updated, and they all supported the mental health diagnosis and the fact that a mother has symptoms. Specifically, Dr. Weatherby testified and in the report explains that mother has symptoms to not only be unable to care for herself, but unable to care for, to maintain stable housing, maintain stable employment, maintain proper social interactions. So also licensed psychologist Frank Weber testified at this trial, who was the underlying professional who completed the parental capacity assessment, and said that his opinion hasn't changed, even though there was discussion about the fact that mother was now chemically clean or had been clean. He explained that because of her past trauma and unresolved trauma, because she hasn't addressed it, hasn't done individual therapy, that my opinion doesn't change here. So if you look at it in that regard, in 2019, the expert who testified regarding the parental ability of mother said that she doesn't have the ability to parent. And actually, if you read that assessment pretty closely, it doesn't only say that she doesn't have the ability to parent, doesn't have the ability to have unsupervised contact with these kids, unless she follows the recommendations. And those recommendations, at a bare minimum, included individual therapy. And that was from 2016. And as your honors correctly noted, 2016, 2019, 3 years have lapsed, and no individual therapy hasn't been completed. In fact, at the trial, mom testified and explained that I'm on a waiting list. Well, if we look back all the way to 2012 in Ohio, the court specifically noted that mother's on a waiting list for mental health services. So again, there's been an ongoing theme here of refusing services. Although offered and ordered by the court, refusing services, explaining that she can recognize her own issues, that she doesn't need medical medication for it, that it's not a priority at this time, among other excuses. So the issues of the parental capacity assessment is largely abuse of discretion. And credibility determination is for the court, and the court determined that licensed psychologist Frank Weber testified credibly, and he provided an opinion at that hearing, which supported his 2016 conclusion. Dr. Weatherby, also a licensed psychologist who provided the updated diagnostic assessment, testified at this trial and explained, although she can't opine as to the parental capacity of mother, because that wasn't the point of the assessment, she does explain that she has mental health symptoms that affect her ability to care for herself. And if she can't be expected to care for herself, she should not be expected to care for her children. Also importantly to note, mom has 5 children. In Ohio, 4 of those children, some her rights to 4 of those children were involuntary transferred. Somehow she got those children back in 2015 while she was in Wadena County. Same issues there, mental health of mother, mental health of the children, and environment, injurious environment. 2017, Meeker County came into the picture and asked mother to voluntarily enter into services. That wasn't complied with. 2018 rolls around, a CHIPS case is filed regarding mother's mental health and the children's mental health. These children have not been in a stable environment, have been in a chaotic environment, and have been out of home for well over a year. In fact, the child in this case is five years old, been out of home for more than 800 days.
Mr. Albright, I was wondering if you could shift from the evidentiary issue on the parental capacity assessor to your second issue, sufficiency of the evidence on the TPR, please.
Yeah, yes, of course, Your Honor. Well, in order to determine palpably unfitness, we look at past history and how things have going. And as I was already indicating, 2012 history in Ohio County, 2015 in Wadena County, 2017 in Meeker County, and now 2019. Importantly, in 2019, mother voluntarily terminated her rights to 2 of the children, saying, I can't parent these 2 children, but I should be allowed to parent this remaining child. That seems to be a conflict here. The kids have significant mental health needs that require a heightened level of care. And because mother can't care for her own mental health needs, she isn't able to care for this child's needs. The child is 5 years old and is diagnosed with a mental illness of disinhibited social engagement disorder, meaning...
Which is that, that's kind of like reactive attachment disorder, is it that sort of condition?
I don't understand exactly the inner workings of that disorder. What I understand it to be is that, in layman's terms, and as the court found, the child seeks out any adult to get her needs met. It could be a stranger, it could be mother, it doesn't matter. It's any, because her needs aren't being met where she's at. There's not a stable environment, and so she's seeking those out. And as the court noted that the foster parent testified to her and explained, stranger danger is what it was classified as. The licensed professional who interviewed the child in this case explained that while in mother's care, it is a chaotic environment and not stable. To move along, The court heard ample evidence. Two updated diagnostic assessments were completed. The parental capacity assessment was completed. So licensed psychologist Frank Weber testified at trial. The court found him credible, reliable, and providing an opinion as to her parental capacity. Then the diagnostic assessment in 2018 by Dr. Weatherby, she testified at trial. The court credited that testimony as reliable and credible. The licensed psychologist of Ms. Linkert, I forget her first name, but Ms. Linkert, she testified at trial. And the court again credited that testimony regarding the child's mental illness, mental instability. And it said that the court correctly credited that a child needs a stable, nurturing environment. And that wasn't happening in mother's care. And there's a track record to prove that. So the court, there's ample evidence to prove that mother is palpably unfit to parent her remaining child. Regarding the two other sub-issues is best interest of the child and reasonable efforts. The best interest of the child, in this case, the court weighed the factors. I mean, this is a detailed, specific finding, weighed the appropriate factors. The child's interest, mother's interest, and any competing interest, and came to a conclusion. Although the appellate doesn't like the conclusion, it's not an abuse of discretion. And lastly, regarding reasonable efforts, mother knew what she had to do. She was asked over and over again to comply with, at minimum, individual therapy. The court correctly noted individual therapy, and that wasn't complied with. At trial, she testified that I'm on a waiting list. She had numerous years to complete individual therapy, or in some way show that she's addressing her mental health, and she wasn't. There was an arms worker in this case, and that was from January 2019. That's when that started. Even though the Dr. Weatherby's assessment explained armed services and individual therapy would be recommended here, armed services wasn't implemented until January 2019, months before the trial. And Rob Hastings, who was the arms worker, testified at trial and explained that he doesn't have the ability or the qualifications to assess mother's parental ability, and explained the task that would be completed would be, here, do X, Y, and Z by the time I, you know, come back at the next visit. Also looked at areas of the house, but all of these were known tasks or known things that were going to be forthcoming. That's not parenting. Parenting comes up at the spry moment. Something happens, you need to be there. Supervision of the child. It's a spontaneous response and reaction and an appropriate one. And in this case, there isn't. There isn't an appropriate response or appropriate reaction, as the experts have explained. 2018, a diagnostic assessment, again, was completed, and mother failed to comply with that. The issue here isn't regarding reasonable efforts as a whole. It was just reasonable efforts as a mental health component. And we can offer all the services in the world, all of them. But if mom's not going to comply with them, even when they're court-ordered, we can't control that. We can't control that. So with that, I don't have anything further unless there's any questions.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Albright. Mr. Mack, you suppose, Mr. Mack, I think your client maybe wanted to.
Thank you.
Very interesting, but unfortunately it's not in the record. Let me just say that she did have some mental health treatment, but suppose that the mother had been able to have her own parental capacities examination, and suppose it had said that she had the capacity to parent. That obviously would have changed the entire picture. So it's a critical piece of this puzzle. We don't know, of course, whether she would have had a favorable examination or not, because she didn't have an examination. And she didn't have an examination because she didn't have the funds for it and the county wouldn't provide it. Counsel said something fairly interesting and true, that the child was out of the home for something like 800 days, and that she had relatively little visitation with the child, certainly not much in-home visitation. But that only goes to stress how very important Fry-Mac is in a case like this, because the court is relying, as counsel noted, almost entirely upon the testimony of experts, such as Dr. Linkert or Dr. Weatherby or Dr. Meyer. And so the reason why the county and the judge has an understanding that this woman cannot parent in the reasonable future and is palpably unfit is precisely because a number of experts say she isn't. And in order to back that up, it becomes absolutely critical to know if these people can pass Dobert or can pass Myers tests. And in a case like this, when we have such critical dependence on expert testimony, the fact that it wasn't specifically brought up by the counsel in this case should be ignored. It's just too important an issue to let go.
Well, maybe an important issue, but you have to preserve it for appeal. And if it's not raised at the district court, we generally don't consider those issues. And to your second point that you raised earlier on plain error, I didn't see any reference to the plain error standard even in the briefing on appeal.
I didn't use the word. But I did indicate, and I did talk about the fact that the council hasn't raised the objection, and I indicated that there are some exceptions to that.
First of all, as Judge Connolly very appropriately pointed out, I'm not aware of the plain error test being used outside of the criminal area, but even assuming that it could be raised, if an issue isn't raised before us, then it's waived on appeal as well. And there has to be case law cited in support of an argument. Otherwise, we don't consider it.
Well, again, as I pointed out before, there may not be case law, but I think there is a rule directly in point which regards expert testimony.
And arguments need to be made in the briefing for nothing else. Notice considerations for opposing counsel, if not to put the issue squarely before us for consideration.
But I think I did. I talked a good deal about Fry Mac, and I talked a good deal about Dobert, and that's in both my brief. For example, I cited, if you'll go to my appendix, Gobe versus Tharaldson, which is the one that says that Fry Mac is even more stringent than Dobert. And of course, I cite Fry Mac in the case. So if you take a look at pages 13, 14, and 15, where I'm talking about Gobe versus Tharaldson and the Fry Mac test, I think it's fair to say that I raised the issue.
The issue of what?
The issue of whether or not there was foundation for the admission of the testimony of the experts, particularly with regard to parental capacities. One of the things that did bother me about the court's analysis and made me wonder a little bit about the expert testimony here is that none of the experts agree on the diagnosis. One has schizophrenia. One has the stranger danger disorder, which is weird because
it's a child. That's not the parent.
Yeah, but with respect to the child, the problem that I see with it is essentially the expert is saying the child is too friendly. I don't know whenever that has been a fault in the child. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. The matter is submitted.